The ruby red pilot light of the Fender Twin Reverb is glowing in the dark. It's time for this edition of Before the Sound Check, the program that offers you a look into the lives and careers of the people who make music happen. We talk up close and intimately with the artists, musicians, producers, engineers, the music teachers, the bus drivers, the production crews, the agents, and the managers. Everyone involved in making the music you love and who bring it to you. Before the Sound Check is sponsored by Thin Stroke Design, an award-winning communications and graphic design studio, and their new book, Love Letters, by internationally recognized typographer and illustrator Tony DiSpigna. The book highlights his classic American Spencerian-style font and lettering designs, the kind you can't do on a computer. That's Love Letters, available on Amazon.com. And now your host, Tony Sarno.
Thank you, Ronnie, and welcome to the show, everybody. Dan Daly's first career was in music, mostly writing it. His covers include hit singles by Charlie Daniels and Johnny Winter. His second career was in writing about music, mainly about the technical side of how it's created and produced. As a journalist, he's considered to be the most widely published writer covering those topics, regularly appearing in magazines such as Mix, Sound on Sound, and Front of House, where he pioneered business writing for these publications. As an author, his 1999 book, Unwritten Rules, Inside the Business of Country Music, became a staple of numerous university reading lists. He lives in Nashville and New York City. Welcome, Dan Daly.
Hey, Tony. How are you?
Pretty good. How you doing?
Pretty good, all things considered, considering we're living here in the time of the plague.
Yeah, I know. A little different than our time in New York. Little backstory here with Dan. I've known Dan since the 80s when we were both struggling musicians in Greenwich Village down in New York City at Kenny's Castaways. Man, a lot of water under the bridge, but it's great. We're still friends. Dan's here in Nashville. Can you just walk me through the bullet points of your career?
My high school band actually got a record deal on Buddha Records back in 1972, 73, somewhere in there. We were label mates with people like the Raspberries and Buzzy Linhart and Charlie Daniels. That album didn't do very well, but that's okay. That's kind of your first time out. But it got me started. It got the wheels spinning under me as a songwriter. Went through a series of publishing deals, which are becoming increasingly scarce in the business, but they were kind of the modus operandi back in those days. And through those, I wound up with hits in the R&B department, R.B. Hudman's This Could Be the Night. Then came Still in Saigon with Charlie Daniels, and then Rain with Johnny Winter. So that was the career. That and at the same time also trying to establish myself as an artist, performing down in venues like you and I worked at Kenny's Castaways on Bleecker Street in the Village, but did a lot of local touring, regional touring, colleges, that kind of thing. But at some point I realized that, yeah, I'm a writer, but I don't have to just be limited to music, and music was changing. It wasn't the kind of, let's just say, artistic milieu that I had started in, which had been very heavily skewed towards classic rock, or what would become classic rock. At the time, it was just rock because that's all there was, and country, and the kind of crossover point of the two of them. So back in the 80s, I was doing two things. I was a partner in a recording studio in Manhattan called Pyramid Studios, and I also went back to college, got a degree in journalism, and since then have been a journalist that basically covers the intersection of entertainment, business, and technology. I've done a lot of that for trade magazines in this sector, like Sound on Sound, Front of House, Mix Magazine, etc., but also written for the New York Daily News, the London Daily Telegraph, the National Post in Canada, and a lot of other general readership publications, including Wired and Fast Company. That takes us up to the present day. That's what I still do right now.
So I think most of our friends and colleagues will say that we didn't choose the music business. The music business chose us. Would you put yourself in that category, Dan?
Tough question, actually. Music was a way out for me. It was a way forward, but also a way out. A way out of home. I was brought up in Queens, New York. We could literally see Manhattan from my mother's backyard. You could see the World Trade Center being built. But we also had factories on the block. It was kind of funky back then. It was a way out. So it beckoned me, but I made myself available, so to speak.
Starting out, did you have any idea about what was involved in becoming a professional musician?
You knew that the ultimate goal was the record deal, which is very different in a lot of ways from the way it is right now. But the ultimate goal was the record deal, and that was the thing that we pursued. And I think getting it so young, like I said, the high school band got the first record deal. Getting it so young made it seem more attainable than it actually was.
Right. And I mean, I read all the books and studied everybody that had made it. I mean, nothing was going to discourage me, but boy, if I'd have known about the heartbreak and the things that one goes through as far as being a professional musician, I mean, I'd still do it, but I had no idea what I was getting into. And kind of an aside with this coronavirus, what do you think we would have done? And let's just go back those decades and we were playing in Kenny's Castaways. What would we have done at that time, do you think, to survive this? Because basically I was playing 4 or 5 nights a week, mostly at Kenny's, but when I was playing with D. Archer, we would play a lot of the bigger shows with Joe Cocker and B.B. King and stuff. But it was all music. And if that stopped like it has now, and particularly in New York City where it's taken over.
It's ground zero in New York, yeah. I don't think it could have been, well, first off, it would not have been nearly as virulent as it is now. First off, the world was not nearly as connected. You don't have people just jumping on airplanes and crossing oceans as a matter of fact, because that's what we do now and what we've done for the last 20 or so years. Back then, everybody was pretty much a lot more local, let's put it that way. Second thing was, back in those days, the record was the main currency. You toured to support record sales. And it wasn't unusual for some of the bigger artists to actually spend months, if not Steely Dan, years in the studio making their records. They didn't have as much, I don't want to say opportunity is a bad word for it, but I mean, the chances of contracting of that kind of contagion just didn't exist like they do now. I mean, you think about it, touring is the currency of the moment. The record itself is almost a tout, a way to say, hey, come see the band when we hit your city. You got that many thousands of people, along with their thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands support personnel. All of a sudden, contagion becomes a much more real thing.
We've both seen, but you as a writer for the pro magazines and stuff, you've seen it transition from a recording an album, as you say, to touring. And now we have no touring and no recording, so now people are taking to the internet and doing live things on the internet. So these are uncharted waters. Do you have any pearls of wisdom where this thing might go?
It's an interesting situation because, as you say, we don't have recording and we don't have touring. Both of those have been constricted for different reasons, of course. But the bottom line is you're not going to suddenly have a renaissance of recording revenues coming out of this just because you can't tour anymore. That doorway was closed pretty much. So what you do have instead is you have a whole lot of artists who have a whole lot of access to the internet. Number one, you still wind up with a lot of the same problem that the internet brought with it, is that, and of course home recording, which is that everybody can make a record, so therefore everybody seems to. And getting through the clutter, finding the music that you want, finding the music that has the quality that you're looking for, becomes more and more difficult because there's just so much out there. But now that you have artists of all levels, let's say, all levels of talent and polish, putting themselves out there doing live shows on the internet, to some extent, it's kind of an equalizing dynamic because everybody is pretty much going to sound the same through a decent microphone and interface and then squashed bandwidth of the internet. But you're going to have to figure out a way to make, if this is going to continue, we're going to have to figure out a way to make that sound better. And I think you're going to see that be a top-down proposition where the artists, just like they used to go to the best producers and the best engineers and the best studios, will find the people who are most adept at optimizing the way music sounds in these kind of new environments.
Dan, we're going to play a song that you wrote that Johnny Winter cut. So give us a little backstory of that.
That was written in the early 80s. And I don't remember the exact inspiration for the song, but I just wanted to get a good minor key blues song that really kind of chugged along. And I couldn't even imagine who I thought of it would have been good for. But because my former manager and still good friend, Alan Pepper, who used to own The Bottom Line, had suggested I go talk to another mutual acquaintance, let's say, whose name escapes me right now, but he was a very interesting character. He was Johnny Winter's manager. And he took it and he said, I don't think Johnny's going to like this.
Wasn't it Teddy Slatus?
Teddy Slatus, exactly. Yeah. Slatus. Teddy Slatus. Teddy had that kind of Damon Runyon New York voice accent quality.
Right.
I don't think Johnny's going to like this. I'll play it for him. Your friend Alan. I don't think Johnny's going to like this. He calls me back a few days later. He says, Johnny loves this.
That's
he really
great.
Loves this. So we wound up with the Johnny Winter cut. It was on the winter of 78, I believe was the name of the album.
Well, great. Here we're going to play a little piece of that Johnny Winter song that Dan Daly wrote called Rain. Well, one of the things I've been thinking about for quite a while when people say, well, there's no more good music, and of course there is. There's some of the newer bands that I like, Revivalists. I think they're real good, and certainly Jason Isbell and these guys in the Americana field. But one of the things has come to light for me is you go back to Sinatra, and he would have the best producer and the best record label. He actually had his own record label eventually called Reprise, which is interestingly, I mean, their catalog was amazing. But anyway, starting from a great producer, a great arranger, okay, and then you're in the studio and an orchestrator.
With a great engineer like Al Schmidt.
Right, and all these guys, they did what they did, and Sinatra just got out there and sang. And now we have our own, you know, publishing companies. We write it, we sing it, we play it, we do all this stuff. And I maintain that going back to the Sinatra model, everybody had their specific role, and the product that came out was just, you know, amazing. And of course, at that time, it was stereo recording. Now we've got unlimited tracks and enough rope, I say, to, you know, when you have that unlimited tracks, you, let's just put some tambourine. Well, maybe you should put some auto harp, you know, and you put these kind of things in, and you can ruin something. As you know, Dan, in having a recording studio, we have what's called mixing through the song, and you know, you got one great mixing. Oh, let's just do one more, and basically you've blown it because you're too far into it. But if we could get back to where everybody had their specialty, I think the music would just be better. I don't know. What's your feeling on that?
It probably would sound better, but you've left out one important ingredient, and that is money. All of those people who were incredibly talented at very, very specific roles, we're going to get a check at the end of the day or the end of the week or the end of the month, whatever it was, to perform those roles. That's something that's sorely lacking right now. And in a sense, that's been compensated for by the fact that people can buy incredibly powerful software and other types of platforms. You can make a record. People do make records on their laptops and on their iPhones. The fact that you've gotten over that particular hump, though, kind of masks the fact that very few people can have all of the talent necessary to create a great song, to perform a great song, and to capture on tape or digital otherwise that same great performance. In other words, expecting one person or two people, maybe three, to do it all is a bridge too far. And as a result, because it's so easy to do, we've got a very, very dense forest of music, much of which is quite mediocre.
Well, Dan, you know, there's no gate master anymore. It used to be where, you know, we'd work really hard and get the band rehearsed, and we'd showcase for record labels, and they'd pass on us, and we'd go back and work harder, and we'd come back and eventually get a record deal. And nowadays, there's none of that. It's just anybody can get music on Spotify. Anybody can do any of that. You can press your own CDs. Of course, nobody buys them anymore.
That whole thing was kind of heralded as, oh, we've freed the music kind of thing. And as it turns out, looking back in retrospect, those kind of constraints actually turned out to have been very good things, because it did give the process of creating music some feedback to say, hey, wait a minute, it's pretty good, but here, try this or try that. Go back, work this a little bit, woodshed that a little bit more. Interestingly, there's a parallel to this in what you brought up before, the recording process itself. You go back four decades, five decades, you were limited to 2, 3, 4, 8, 12, 16, maybe 24 tracks as time went by. And that was it. That was all the real estate you had to capture those performances. After a while, you just couldn't put anything else on there, so you had to make decisions as you went along. The process, the performance process, and the composing process, and the production process were all together. Now, like you said before, we've got an unlimited number of tracks. People sit there and just dump kitchen sinks onto them, and then later try to figure out where the song is when they get the mix, or dump it in the lap of a mixer who they'll pay to say, hey, see if you can find a song in there somewhere. It's really the same thing.
You also wrote a song that Charlie Daniels cut called Still in Saigon. What can you tell us about that, Dan?
Now, that was probably the biggest hit I had. That got to be a top 20 for Charlie Daniels as a single. It's long and convoluted. Here's what I will tell you about that song. One thing it wound up doing was introducing me to the very, very diverse and interesting world of Vietnam veterans. And I still to this day get emails, I get letters from veterans of that war asking me questions about it, or just wanting to let me know that the song made a difference for them, and it's very heartwarming for me. But what I've come to realize, what I didn't know at the time when I wrote the song, here's what I've realized. I'll put it to you this way. Still in Saigon is about Vietnam like Moby Dick is about a whale.
Right, right.
It's a metaphor. It's a metaphor for other things that would take a lot longer than a half an hour radio show to go into. But I'll leave you with that. It may be a little bit enigmatic, but when you think about it, it's actually kind of cool.
Okay, well, Still in Saigon, Charlie Daniels cut Dan Daly's song. Here it is. We'll be right back.
My younger brother calls me a killer and my daddy calls me a vet. Everybody says I'm someone else, that I'm sick and there's no cure. Damned if I know who I am. There was only one place I was sure when I was still in Saigon. Still in Saigon.
What do you think you would want to do if you weren't in the music biz? I mean, was there anything else that you entertained as a kid?
Well, I did it.
Well, no, but I mean, you're still in the music business, Dan. I mean, I think you stayed very relevant.
Let's put it this way. I stepped to the side. I'm riding on the outside of the train instead of the inside of it. Let's put it that way. I in answer to your specific question, there's nothing else I would have done. I wanted to be a writer from day one. I just happened to start writing music first. Since then, I've been writing prose. What might be left is poetry, but I doubt I'll do
Well,
that.
But I mean, it's still the entertainment business. And I think all my musician friends and yourself included, we're all what I call lifers.
You know, let's put it this way. You have something to say, you'll find a way to express it, probably artistically. There's some beautifully elegant stuff in mathematics, but I just don't have the chops to do math.
Right, so that's not
something that I would step. Well, you put a dollar sign in front of it, I'm pretty good with them.
Okay.
But if I needed to express whatever it is I need to express, words through one milieu or another is how I do it. I couldn't do it with math. I couldn't do it with sculpture. I couldn't do it with painting. Maybe a mob accountant might have been. Hey, you know, that's pretty creative right there.
Let's go to our last question here. What are your five favorite songs?
An impossible question to answer, but there's a lot of stuff that I like. I mean, I will go back to classic rock over and over and over again. I still think Boston's More Than a Feeling is probably the best song ever to come out of the 70s.
Right. So let's say a song comes on the radio, and no matter what, you can't turn it off.
That's one, More Than a Feeling. Can't turn that off. In fact, got to turn it up.
Right, okay. And what else is like that?
let's see. Almost anything by George Jones, especially the older stuff.
Yep.
Certainly anything by Led Zeppelin. I mean, granted, I'm dating myself here a little bit. I mean, some Mark Kendrick stuff, some of the Drake stuff. I won't even go with individual songs because I have some... I definitely have some feelings about what constitutes a song, but there's beats that I can listen to for days and days and days too. DJ Khaled or Kool & Dre, you know, guys who are really classic beat makers who can take the beat,
right?
Who can take what's called a beat and turn it into a song for somebody like a Beyonce or for Mary J. Blige or people like that,
right?
You know, there's a lot of great stuff there, and it doesn't necessarily start with a song. It starts with a beat, but a beat's a very cool, interesting, complex, intimate thing. I've gotten into them, and it's become a whole career path for people. They're just like there were people out there whose songs never got on the radio, but they did okay with backing tracks to soap operas and things like that or commercials. Beat makers out there who'll never write a hit song, but they write beats that become the foundations for hit songs.
Right, right. Well, Dan, it looks like we're just about out of time, but Dan Daly, thanks so much. You're a good friend and a great musician, great writer, and thanks so much for
happy to be here.
Thanks for being on the show. We'll talk to you soon.
Okay, buddy. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Well, that wraps it up for this show. Thanks for joining us, and I'd like to thank our sponsor, Thin Stroke Design, an award-winning communication and graphic design studio, and their new book, Love Letters, by internationally recognized typographer and illustrator Tony DeSpigna. The book highlights his classic American Spencerian-style font and lettering designs, the kind you just can't do on a computer. That's Love Letters, available on Amazon.com. I'm Tony Sarno, and thank you for joining us on Before the Soundcheck. I'd like to close out with another song written by our guest Dan Daly, a song I recorded called Money on the Side.
And the landlord, you gotta find a little something for you. A little money on the side, a little money on the side, yeah. A little honey you can hide, a little green peace of mind. A little money on the side. Now your name's not Rockefeller. Behind your back they call you trash. Well, maybe the people a truck, a little